education team for Jackson Family Wines proudly brings you these podcasts for your listening enjoyment.
Bonjour, Bud Break. It is Katie Werthmuller, winery ambassador and educator for the Maritime Portfolio. And today I am here for a very fun topic that we all know and love as far as drinking in our glass. But I'm with David Royce. Hello, David.
Hello, Katie. How are you?
I am great. I obviously listened to your podcast with Elise from Champagne on Rio and excited to have that and have Jackson Family Wines be the exclusive importer for it. But I was thinking that some people are just getting into the industry or maybe don't know as much about Champagne. So starting back to the basics, where we can go through just some pretty introductory discussion on what is Champagne, where is it, what's the difference with other sparklings, talking a little bit about things that might be on a label, how to serve it, all of those kind of things. And you are the perfect expert to chat with me today and run through this.
Thank you. Yeah, Champagne is my spirit animal. Champagne is my desert island wine. The greatest bottle of wine I've ever tasted was a Champagne. So excited to be here and spread the gospel. So excited to be exclusive with Champagne on Rio. And it's a match made in heaven. And I can't wait to tell you all about my favorite part in part of the whole wide world.
So what was that one bottle though?
That was Krug 2002 Clos de Menil, and I got it on sale for $800.
And nice, on sale. Always love a sale.
Love a sale. And I told my wife, and she was like, David, are you on drugs? You bought a bottle of wine for $800? And I said, yes, it's going to be worth it. And then I, on my third attempt, passed my advanced exam, and we went back to Frasca, sitting with my mentor, Bobby Stuckey, and my wife and some Psalms, and we opened the Champagne and we're drinking it and celebration all around. And my wife turns to me and says, David, this is $800 good. I'm like, see, I told you.
Amazing.
Yummy. Yes.
And the thing I love too, just hearing you talk to Elise, was like this region that's rooted in tradition and these houses are preserving what they've been doing for a really long time. 2 centuries plus of producing wines, and you're drinking a bottle that's this celebration for you. I love thinking back of these regions where the wines are made and who's been behind them for years and years and years.
It's steeped in history, and it's so cool to think that bottle was, grapes were harvested in 2002. I was a sophomore in high school, just this little 16-year-old knucklehead. And then all these years later, to open that bottle with my friends and my mentor and my wife, that bottle had been sleeping in the cellars in Champagne for decades. And then to be able to share it with the most important people in my life, that's a pretty high bar. I'm not sure if I can ever drink a better bottle, but Champagne is a celebration in a glass, to say the least. So beautiful.
Love it. Well, this region, that's what, about a 45-minute drive outside of Charles de Gaulle, we fly in. Let's talk about the location. Why don't you give us some information on the location of Champagne, what makes it important to climate-wise?
Yeah, so fly into Paris, and then they have a high-speed train. It takes about 45 minutes, as you mentioned. There is no city called Champagne. You'll go straight to the main city is called Reims, and the locals say it in a tricky French way, but Reims is as close as we can get in terms of English pronunciation. And as mentioned, it is a delimited area. Champagne is a beautiful region. And the saying, it can only be Champagne if it comes from the Champagne region in France. The joke that it's only existentialism if it comes from the existentialism region in France. Otherwise, it's just sparkling anxiety. It has to be Champagne specifically. And the reason for that is because Champagne is very protective of their trademark. When you buy a bottle of Champagne, you know exactly where it's coming from, but who produced it, what grapes are going to be inside. It's a very protected trademark because they want authenticity in the bottle. The other end of the spectrum, you think about natural wine. What does that mean? There's no regulation, so it's really the Wild West, whereas champagne is the exact opposite. It is tightly regulated, so you know exactly what's in the bottle. There are three main regions within Champagne. There is the Côte Blanc, which is in the south. That is the main growing region for Chardonnay. Then going kind of clockwise, you have the Vallée de la Marne, where Pinot Meunier is a popular grape. And then to the north, we have the Montagne de Reims, and Pinot Noir is grown primarily there. And those are the three major grapes that you would find in a bottle of champagne, each bringing something different to the blend and also an insurance policy, really, that we're super far north in latitude. This climate is incredibly cool. Some years, certain grapes don't ripen all the way. And then other years, different grapes do. So this blending across not only different grapes, but also uniquely across multiple years can help champagne make a consistent and delicious style.
And then we're looking at pretty wet, kind of windy, coming off of the Atlantic Ocean, big dino ships, correct?
Yeah, huge. It's the furthest north latitude growing region for grapes. There's very limited sunshine hours. Grapes need, depending on the metric you look at, you need 1,200 to 1,500 sunlight hours in a year to even ripen a grape. And some years are cold and wet, and champagne is not very high quality. So it's very cool climate, and these grapes
a
are
lot
just
of risk.
Right on the huge
Sorry
risk.
To interrupt, a lot yeah. of risk. Just, you know, hail, yeah. and we hear about that a lot, and rot and mold, and just things that can happen when you're in a damp climate like that.
Truly. I mean, that's one thing. Coming into wine, it's important to realize we are at the mercy of Mother Nature. This is an agricultural product, and frost and hail and migratory birds and earthquakes and fungus and mold and disease pressure and earthquakes. And there's a million things that can go wrong. So when we do end up with a beautiful bottle of wine, it is by the grace of God sometimes. So yeah, great region, but marginal in terms of grape growing opportunities.
But that marginal climate is going to give us what's perfect for champagne, right? We want higher acid, lower alcohol base wines when we're putting together and producing champagne. So this is the perfect place for that.
Absolutely. And what's cool is as a grape ripens throughout its growing season, basically the acidity in the grape more or less will convert into sugar. So a super, super hot climate, the acids plummet and the sugars skyrocket. Whereas a nice cool climate like Champagne, the acids will come down, the sugars will start to come up. But at the end of the day, very tart, very mouthwatering, very high acid base wines that make for really crispy, crunchy, beautiful, food-friendly, tart, mouthwatering wines that fill me with joy.
That's the perfect transition to let's get into the crux. So one of the main things we want to get across to everybody today is how is champagne specifically made, or method champenois, or method tradition? So that's the main talk here, but there's also multiple ways, other ways where bubbles can be made. So we'll make sure we get through the main steps of producing champagne and then talk about the others as well.
Great. Yeah. So champagne is effectively a wine that's, you make it twice. And so just rudiments here, we have base wine being made. We have grape juice, introducing yeast to eat that sugar. That yeast converts sugar into alcohol and carbon dioxide. And when making a traditional wine, it'll eat up all that sugar. You end up with a base wine, say, of traditionally between 12 and 15% alcohol. And all that carbon dioxide that we mentioned will float up into the atmosphere and dissipate. But what makes champagne really unique is that they'll make that base wine, and it's a cool climate with very little sugar to begin with. So you'll end up at about 11% alcohol, incredibly tart, high acid, searingly high acid base wines. And then they'll take that juice, put it in the literal bottle, that you buy at the end of this process, they'll put a little more sugar, a little bit of yeast, and put a bottle cap on it. Then that fermentation process starts again. The yeast eat the sugar.
Just to note, that mix of the sugar, yeast, and nutrients that get added into the bottle is called the liqueur de tirage. So this process is called tirage when we are adding in this formula, which is going to basically create that second process of fermentation.
Nice. Correct. Yes. There's some champagne is famous for a lot of French technical terms, and that would be one. Certainly looking at also assemblage, which is effectively the assembly, the blend of the different grapes, each bringing something different to the wine. And we'll touch on more technical French as well as we go. So
yes, we all need a French lesson. And I think one thing that for those that are just getting into champagne is that each of these base wines could be fermented. That first fermentation could happen in stainless steel, or it could happen in barrel, predominantly neutral oak, but that base wine could come from different types of fermentations, correct?
Oh, yeah. And then ultimately it could end up tasting completely different. And that's part of the magic, that what grapes you use, the vintage the grapes are grown in, the fermentation vessel, how much you blend, how long you age the bottle, what you add for the dosage. There's an infinite rubric of variables that end up making champagnes that taste completely different. And there's no way to figure it out exactly until you taste it personally. And that's the fun, is the exploration. So,
well, and very important is after you go through that process, this carbon dioxide is trapped in the bottle. Like, it gets stuck in there. So what?
Correct.
What do we do after this happens?
So we have that literal bottle that we will eventually buy, but that yeast has eaten the sugar, and it has created about 1% to 1.5% higher base alcohol level. And then that carbon dioxide that would blow off in a traditional fermentation is now in that bottle in a sealed container. That carbon dioxide then dissolves into the base wine itself. So those are the bubbles. Since the carbon dioxide cannot escape, it effectively dissolves into the liquid, and that is the sparkle. That is how the bubbles are effectively added to this base wine. And now we're stuck with this dead yeast in this base wine. It's cloudy, it's hazy, it adds flavors and aromas, but at the end of the day, I don't want a cloudy, hazy glass of sparkling wine. So thankfully, actually, the widow Clicquot of Veuve Clicquot Champagne, she in the 1800s devised a way to get the dead yeast cells out of the bottle. And it's called remuage, or riddling. And effectively, they'll hold the champagne bottle in what's called a pupitre, is this effectively big triangle with holes for bottles. They'll put it in sideways and slowly twist and invert the bottle, shaking all those dead yeast cells all the way down to the bottle cap over the course of 2 to 4 weeks. And then at the very end, they will disgorgement. They'll basically dip the end of that wine bottle in a freezing solution. They'll pop open the bottle cap, and it'll shoot out the dead yeast cells. Then they will add what's called dosage. So this is a sweetened syrup that will balance the wine. When we talk about sugar levels, this is basically where it's coming from. As we mentioned, this is incredibly tart. This is high acid. This is mouthwatering. They'll add dosage to balance that. You know, you think about lemonade. Lemon juice, way too tart. Sugar water, way too sweet. But the balance of the two, that acidic and sugar flavors, make a beautiful beverage. And that's what they'll do. They'll add a little bit of sugar to balance the acidity in that champagne. But again, that's a stylistic choice. A lot of different producers do a lot of different things. But at the end of the day, we'll put a big cork in it. They'll put that wire cage, the mousselet, as it's called. They'll twist it 6 times, and then they'll put the cap on it, and they can age it for longer, or they'll ship it out and have it available for you to drink. So that broad strokes, that's how we make champagne.
And there we have it. It sounds so simple. A couple of questions. So about how long does that second fermentation in the bottle, about how long does that take?
So that takes roughly about 2 weeks. And then the interesting point here is that those dead yeast cells, they'll die. They run out of sugar for fuel. So they will die and fall to the bottom of the bottle. And the longer the winemaker lets that bottle of wine sit there for months or years or even decades, the champagne itself picks up more flavors of that yeast. And it is yeasty. You know, really, really long-aged champagne tastes like biscuit and bread dough and stale beer. And it adds this biscuity, toasty richness. So it's a stylistic choice. Obviously,
and it's an
age for... Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. I was going to say a minimum of 12 months. So it has to be at least 12 months. And then,
correct.
But again, the stylistic choice could be however long. And I will tell you, just I'll enter here, one of my most memorable champagne moments, I was at Champagne Delamotte and we went to lunch and they brought a bottle, and I probably should have double checked my notes. It was either 88, 89. It was a late 80s vintage that hadn't been disgorged yet. And this was about 12 years ago. So this was 2012. And they disgorged it at lunch. So that was one of my most memorable, obviously very yeasty because it had been on the lees for so long. But that was a pretty, pretty memorable moment to see something disgorged with that amount of age.
And, you know, the longer it ages, the more toasty, biscuity, and brioche that champagne will be. But also then, invariably, that's inventory that the champagne house is sitting on and waiting and cannot sell. So every time you have a longer age champagne, the champagne house is more and more on the hook in terms of inventory. So invariably, that's always going to be expensive or even way more expensive. Yeah.
So that's obviously a very aged champagne, and you just explained that beautifully. But what makes just even a non-vintage brut more expensive than other sparkling wines? I mean, we know the popularity of Prosecco has grown. We see Cava out there. There's so many values. Why is champagne so expensive? Obviously, this process we described is a labor of love. But what else is going on?
I'd say the format in which the bubbles are incorporated into the wine is a huge differentiation there. Prosecco is very similar in a lot of ways. It is a sparkling wine from northeastern Italy, made in incredibly high volumes. And the main difference here, champagne is done literally bottle by bottle. You can make 750 milliliters at a time, whereas Prosecco is done in a method called Charmat. So that secondary fermentation that happens in the bottle with champagne happens in an enormous stainless steel tank in Prosecco. Mm. And they can then make, instead of one bottle at a time, they're making thousands and thousands and thousands of bottles at a time. And there's also no age restriction for Prosecco. In fact, the fresher, the better, very often with Prosecco.
I would say so, I don't really want my Prosecco with too much age.
Right. Aged Prosecco is, well, it's not built for that. And in fact, they can do that secondary fermentation in 2 weeks, bottle it, ship it. So instead of, say, bare minimum, a year of aging, we're looking at Prosecco out the door in about a month. So that's right. It's a much more simple beverage, but it's a much more fiscally responsible beverage. And Prosecco plays to that strength, whereas champagne is rich and complex and nuanced. There's a place to it. There's often single vineyard expressions of champagne. And also, as you mentioned with climate, at least 5% of every single champagne harvest is lost to frost and hail and disease.
Right.
So it's a pretty marginal region. It's not primo in terms of making huge high volume wine, but it's really, really beautiful at making smaller, more boutique style compared to Prosecco.
Beautiful. Thank you. So we're looking at somebody's shopping for champagne, or one of our sales team members is packing their bag with different champagnes and they're looking at the label, and there's a lot of words maybe that a lot of folks don't know exactly what those translate to in terms of what's in the bottle. And so I would say that the main ones, that are most important, first and foremost, would be, is it brut, brut nature, extra brut, all of those. Those are basically telling you what that dosage level is after the disgorgement. Let's talk about some things on the label. What do you think are most important?
Yeah, I would agree. Brut is the big one. And I'll never forget, I was in a liquor store back in college, and someone next to me was holding two bottles, I believe, of lower priced domestic sparkling. And he, one said Brut and one said Demi-Sec. And he was really hemming and hawing. And he even said out loud, "What, Brut? What is that?" And I couldn't help myself. I said, "Brut means there's very little added sugar. It's quite tart and mouthwatering. And the Demi-Sec has quite a bit of sugar. It's sweeter." And he looked over at me, he says, "How could you know that?" I'm a dork. I'm a big wine dork, and I can't help myself. So as mentioned, dosage, the addition of sugar at the very, very end of bottling to balance that, the acidity of the finished wine. Brut is what you'll see about 4 out of 5 bottles. About 80% of all production is Brut, and that means that at the end, they'll add, on the high end, 12 grams per liter, all the way conceivably down to zero, but usually in the sweet spot, about 6 to 8 grams of residual sugar they'll add back in to the champagne. It does not make it sweet, but it balances that searing acidity that we talked about can happen. And that is a really what you'd see a lot of the time. It is a sliding scale. It goes down to Brut Nature, which is no dosage whatsoever, and it is laser beamy and bone lemon dry. Juicy. Bone dry, exactly. Brut Sauvage, that's another synonym. It is no sugar, and it is like lime juice. It is, if you're interested in that style, Brut Nature is delicious, but if you want a little more balance, Brut is usually the sweet spot, and then it goes up to Demi-Sec, which is noticeably sweet, and then all the way into Doux, D-O-U-X, which is French for sweet, and it is a true dessert-style champagne. Historically, the sweet style dominated, but now, as mentioned, about 80% of what you'd find today will be Brut.
And then there's extra Brut, which falls just in between Brut Nature and Brut, correct? So that's like around zero, like either no dosage or to 6, I think.
Correct. Yeah. 6 grams per liter. So yeah, walking down.
But we don't see that as much.
And it's a stylistic choice. I can think of a few bottles that say extra Brut, but that's a way to just let the guest know that this will be drier, on the drier side. And then Brut Nature or Brut Zero, Brut Sauvage, that means get ready for lemon juice, because it is like the enamel of your teeth will cry out when you drink some of those styles. But again, Brut is our kind of our bread and butter. That's where most champagnes land.
And then the other big majority, and something we see on the label more often than not, is the NV, the non-vintage.
Yeah, that is, again, this is an insurance policy. We're so far north that, as opposed to say Napa Valley, where the grapes ripen beautifully and fully every single year, you go super far north in latitude. Champagne, some vintages are cool and cold, and the grapes maybe never ripen the right way. So non-vintage, NV, is about 90% of all total champagne production. And this is a blend of multiple years. So Henriot is trying to create a very distinct style. But that's really hard to do when, say, 2003 is this incredible heat wave where the grapes can almost raisin, and then 2004, super, super cool climate and tart and mouthwatering. So what do? You blend multiple years together. Let's say we'll start with 15, which was great. 16 is good. 17 was fantastic. Kind of buffering all those extremes, blending those different years of grapes together to make a very consistent style. So that does segue into, you might see the word millésime, which is French for year, and that is the other end of the coin. Instead of blending multiple years to get a nice, consistent, homogenous house style. Millésime is only the wine harvested in one specific year. And that can be absolutely phenomenal. Let's say 2002, the wine that I drank from Krug, that was a banner year. The grapes ripened perfectly, absolutely delicious wine, and a true expression of the growing season. Whereas, let's say 2007, challenging. And a lot of champagne houses, when the vintage is poor, they don't even make a vintage declaration. They say, we'll blend this in when we have other stock, but when we drink it on its own, it's not great. So, right.
And those need to be aged longer in the cellar too, 36 months minimum for vintage. So a slight difference in production as well once they've been in bottle.
Yeah, minimum 3 years. So any vintage champagne that you would see out in the market, there's at bare minimum a 3 and more likely a 4 or more year lag time between harvest and actually seeing the bottle out in the wild. Very often, vintage champagnes or Millésime champagnes will go maybe 10 years on the lees in the cellars until they're released to the public, but still complex, rich, powerhouse, beautiful wines, but obviously often quite a bit more expensive.
And then as far as some of the styles that we'll see, Blanc de Blanc, Blanc de Noir, and also Rosé, we could touch on that, and then the Tête de Cuvée.
Yeah, so Blanc de Blanc, white from white in French, that is a wine made exclusively with white grapes. So famously Chardonnay, and to me, I always say Blanc de Blanc champagne is like a green apple cut with a steel knife. It is very focused, it is linear. It is incredibly, my favorite. Yes, it is one of my absolute favorite. In fact, my dream bottle, the 2002, Clos de Menil, is a Blanc de Blanc. It is all Chardonnay. Very focused, very linear, and absolutely delicious. Then the other half of the coin would be a Blanc de Noir, or white from black. As you know, all red grapes have clear juice. So a red Pinot Noir grape still has white juice inside. So a Blanc de Noir will be red grapes crushed quickly away from the skin, so you still end up with a white wine. And to me, Blanc de Noir always is richer and rounder, more texture, more red apple skin and red plum, more kind of red fruit components, but still a white wine. And then last, as you mentioned, rosé champagne. A lot of people are a little hesitant sometimes drinking rosé champagne because they assume it's going to be sweet, but I'd say 99% of the time it will not be. What's really cool is that in the region of Champagne, it's the only region in all of France that you make a rosé by blending still red wine into traditional white champagne base wines. So you'll make effectively a few barrels of traditional Pinot Noir that sits with the skins for a couple of weeks and a beautiful red wine. And then you'll blend in small proportions to your base wines to make the champagne that way. So usually the price is a little bit higher, but adds this really beautiful floral component, red fruit, red raspberry, and strawberry, adding a lot of the similarities of the traditional champagne, but layering on these beautiful red fruit aromas and flavors for a much more complex and really delicious wine.
Then the last thing that you might find in the style when it comes to non-vintage, and then there's vintage wines, and then there's the Tête de Cuvée. So that sounds very prestigious, and that is what it is. Tell us about the Tête de Cuvée.
Almost every single champagne house has a Tête de Cuvée, effectively their flagship, their high-end, famous names. Roederer makes Cristal, Moët & Chandon will make Dom Pérignon. And these are the big names, the big houses. If you look on any champagne wine list, they're at the bottom and they're the most expensive. Champagne Henriot makes Cuvée Emera. That's their Tête de Cuvée. And effectively, this is almost always a single vintage and the best grapes from the best plots aged for, on average, around 8 to 10 years. And this is the best of the best. This is the ultimate expression of the terroir of the grapes of the house. Hugely expensive, but this is really the crown jewel of any champagne producer's portfolio.
Well, let's kind of wrap things up talking about service. So now I'm ready for a glass of champagne right now.
So, me too.
If we were in the same place, I would say, okay, tell me right now and show me the best way to serve champagne.
I'd be happy to. And now this is the dangerous part, because as we mentioned, there's a lot of pressure. All that dissolved carbon dioxide is pressurized a bottle of champagne. There is as much pressure in a bottle as a truck tire. So if you're not careful and conscious, you can really hurt yourself. That cork can fly out at incredible speeds. You can break a light. You could take someone's eye out. This is the only way to really do badly in a service exam when you're studying, is if you lose control of the cork, because people can get hurt. So very briefly, put your thumb over the top. Never let that thumb off the top until the cork is out. I see a lot of people untwist the cage, 6 half twists, and then they'll take the cage off completely.
Don't point it towards you.
And then point it towards me. Do not point the champagne bottle as soon as you untwist it. One half twist, I've seen it, the cork will shoot itself out. So as soon as you untwist that cage, effectively the gun is loaded. So safety first, do not point it at anyone or a dog or a light fixture, and keep that thumb over the end. 6 half twists. I like to push in to my hand. I'll push the wire cage in to unseat it off that lip. Thumb stays on, and then I'll grab the bottom of the bottle, because if it's wet and slippery and you're holding it kind of a barrel grip, it can slip out of your hands and shoot down onto the ground. I've had that happen. That was a disaster. So always cup the bottom of the bottle, thumb on the top, and then slowly twist back and forth. With all that pressure, you'll feel that cork start to ease itself out. And then just a gentle sigh of release of that gas. You want a whisper, effectively. Don't pop it out loud. In a formal setting, you want to be as discreet about this as possible. And then you've successfully opened the champagne. I've had every single type of disaster possible with opening champagne. So be calm, be confident, practice in your house, and always keep that thumb on the top. Have control, because you can hurt yourself or others very, very easily. I've done it. So learn from my mistakes.
And temperature will help too. So if it's too warm, you're going to get even more of that when it starts overflowing. So usually around that like 45, 50 degrees, making sure you have a nice chill on it to avoid some extra loss of the champagne.
Exactly.
And then glassware. So I know everybody, I like to use the white wine glass, but some people are like, why are you not drinking out of a flute? So let's talk about that real quick.
Yeah, famously, you think champagne, you think flute, and that's great. Really, though, the champagne flute, it optimizes for what the wine looks like. It optimizes seeing the wine, which out of all the things that I do with champagne, seeing the wine is probably my third favorite thing. So while it looks beautiful with these streams, long streams of bubbles coming up, it doesn't really let you enjoy the wine. At the end of the day, especially some of these older vintages, these are beautifully crafted wines that need some air to open up. They need a nice big bowl to capture that aroma and to let the wine also warm up just a touch. Usually we'll pull it right out of the ice bucket, but it does show better aroma and flavor if it warms up on the table a little bit. So flutes look beautiful, but at the end of the day, a traditional white wine glass allows the aroma to build, the wine to warm just a touch. It showcases everything that wine has to offer, as opposed to looking pretty and a little flute. I can't get my nose in there. Effectively, you can't really smell champagne in a tight little flute. A big white wine glass lets you truly enjoy everything that the wine has to offer. But at the end of the day, follow your heart. If you want flutes, then drink it out of flutes. If you prefer a huge goblet of a wine glass, then go for that. You know, wine is fun. There's no There's no real rules, but we're just going to give you some guideposts along the way.
And obviously there's specific food and wine pairings that I'd love to hear from you, but I mean, I love champagne with many, many dishes and kicking off a celebration. What are your favorite champagne pairings?
Fried chicken and champagne.
Of course, that French fries.
Of course, French fries. Champagne with that really high acidity, it is mouthwatering. You salivate, you get hungry, like it primes your body for food. And really, you think about any food that comes with a lemon, that is perfect fare for champagne. Let's take calamari. Why does it come with a lemon? Well, it's fatty, it's savory, it's rich. It needs acidity to balance the dish. So you have all the acidity you could ever want with a glass of champagne, plus this toasty brioche richness and this beautiful flavor. Anything fried is a match made in heaven for champagne, but also sushi, and even go crazy. I've had ribeye steak and old vintage champagne, and there's almost no wrong answer when it comes to champagne food and wine pairing. It's very versatile. Whenever I get stuck and don't know what to pair in a menu, I'll usually defer to champagne because it's delicious, it's fun, and it 9 times out of 10 works beautifully.
Okay, I'm ready. I'm ready for a glass, but I think we probably need to wrap it up. I know we wanted to keep this very concise, but there's so much to talk about with champagne and obviously other sparkling as well. So we're thankful that you all stayed and tuned in and listened to us go on about how champagne is made, what's on the labels, and how, most importantly, to drink it. So thank you, David, for your time. Thank you, listeners, for your time. And we will be back with a little more in-depth look at champagne as well. So cheers to all of you.
Cheers, Katie. Thank you.